here at No Nonsense Nutrition, we're always looking at what is topical in the news. And, you know, that year rolled over. And hopefully it didn't roll over you. And one of the things that I was fascinated about was hearing the most Googled New Year's resolutions, especially when I heard about number 10, which was how to crochet a cap. Well, here in beautiful, sunshiny Sarasota, we don't need to crochet very many caps. So that's what got me curious as to what were the rest of the big 10 of the most Googled resolutions. And I'll save you the sound effects, the drum rolls, and the trumpet blares, and tell you that number 9 was how to steam broccoli. You know, it does a girl's heart good when she finds out that one of the most Googled New Year's resolutions was how to steam broccoli. But here's the surprise. The surprise is that study was done on steaming broccoli, boiling broccoli, and microwaving broccoli, and ta-da, guess one had the most nutrition? Yeah, it was the microwave broccoli. Who knew? We always thought steaming it did the job. Well, you know, broccoli really is a magical vegetable. I've talked about broccoli, and I'm going to talk about others of the brassica family, the cruciferia family, here on the show today. But broccoli is a magical ingredient because it's got great vitamin C and great fiber and great sulfur in it. And so some of the people who say I can't eat broccoli, they can't because of the amount of sulfur. Remember, that's not sulfa. It's not the drug. It's sulfur, the mineral. You know what you do? You take that little basket. You put it in the bottom of the saucepan with an inch of water. You bring the water to a boil. You put the broccoli in it. Depending on how big your pieces are, you leave it from anywhere from 3 to 7 minutes. Do you like it squishy? The longer it's in there, the less vitamin C it's going to have. Do you like it crispy? Well, it depends on the size that you cut it to, and it depends on how squishy you like it. So that's it for number 9, how to steam broccoli. But what really blew my mind was that number 8 was how to cook collard greens. You know, here in the South, we've had a tradition. It's gone on for a really long time of having collard greens and black-eyed peas on New Year's Day. A way to bring good luck. And I'd have to add cornbread to that because collard greens and black-eyed peas and cornbread, baby, it don't get any better than that. Well, I had the really good fortune when it came to number 8 on how to cook collard greens that all I had to do is walk out the garage door and I could pick my fresh collard greens an hour before I ate them, right out of my garden. Yeah, collard greens will grow even in the cool weather. They're one of the things that actually like that cool weather. Like kale and turnip greens and mustard greens and Swiss chard and some of these other dark leafy greens, they actually get sweeter when they get a little bit of chill on them. And so I pick those fresh leaves, and you really don't want to get those leaves that are as big as elephant ears. If you can get smaller leaves of collards, it's definitely an advantage. And so I picked the leaves that were maybe about the size of a bread and butter plate. Not quite that wide and a little longer. They're sort of oval. And you can chop those stems up into about quarter-inch pieces and sort of saute them in a little olive oil and onion. That'll work before you take the collards, lay them on top of each other, put them on the cutting board, and just slice them into one-inch strips and throw them in some boiling water and that's all you got to do. You know, Grandma used to cook collard greens on the back of the stove for hours and hours and hours. What's really true is you can steam them, you can saute them, you could even ribbon them up and eat them raw. You can put them into juicer. There's lots of things you can do with collards because, get ready for the drum roll, collards really are the new kale. Yeah, there's a bunch of Southern cookbooks that are showing up. And they're talking about using collards in all sorts of new ways. You know, we're going to talk about kale a little later in the show, but kale has really been getting the press. It's been getting the spotlight on it. But when we realize that this new generation of chefs and cooks are taking collards to places our grandmothers never even imagined, they're grinding them into pesto, they're putting raw collards into salads and slaws, they're pickling the stems, they're putting the leaves into juice, and you know what? It's all really good. In fact, I was at a restaurant a couple of months ago where they actually took the soft-cooked collards and used them as a roll-up wrapper for making a burrito. So whether it's, you know, collard dolmades, you know, where the grape leaves are often used, or it's collards pesto, what's true is that you can put them into soup. How about with some butternut squash and some chickpeas? Yeah, baby. You know, blanch young collard leaves and grind them up. Make a spread out of them. They're so emblematic of the South. If you cook up collards, it pretty much says, I'm cooking Southern. And then you put that modern spin on it. So they're in the same botanical family as cabbages and turnips and kohlrabi and broccoli and cauliflower and bok choy and arugula and watercress. And, you know, it's a big family. All have high levels of vitamin C. All of them contain selenium and fiber. But with the amount of kale fatigue that's starting to show up now, collards, well, I was really glad to see they made it to number 8. You know, I have to skip up number 7, how to write a letter of recommendation, because that's not my turf. My turf is number 6, how to cook cabbage. As far as I'm concerned, cabbage is one of nature's most nearly perfect foods. Cabbage gives us an opportunity to eat it raw, to eat it cooked, to put it in everything that you can name, from a side dish to a salad to a main dish. I grew up with my mother's famous cabbage rolls. And if it wasn't for the fact that we've only got a break for lunch and we don't start from zero at lunch every day, I'd be making fresh coleslaw every day prior to lunch. Cabbage, high in fiber, high in vitamin C, really inexpensive. When I talked recently about the fact that we could eat well and eat cheap at the same time, I want you to know that cabbage is on the top of the list of that particular direction, because there's hardly anything cheaper out there, and cabbage happens to be in the Clean 15 list, meaning that it is one of the 15 fruits and vegetables that has the lowest rate of pesticide residue. So even if you don't buy an organic cabbage, and I'd of course prefer that you do, because remember, every dollar you spend at the grocery store is a vote for telling the American food supply what it is that we're looking for. But cabbages are cheap. And you can use a little or you can use a lot. You know, it's real easy to just slice a hunk of cabbage off one of those heads and just chop it up and throw it into your lettuce salad. It's real easy to blanch those outside cabbage leaves and make cabbage rolls, whether you're a vegetarian or a vegan and you're going to make it with rice and onions and celery and herbs, or whether you're going to put some ground meat into it, using that ground turkey and browning it with some onions and then mixing that in with the rice and rolling it up in that cabbage leaf or that collard green leaf. Yummy! But my favorite is still coleslaw. I could eat coleslaw 365 days a year. And I happen to like the slaw that's a little bit sweet. You know, one of the real treats I have in my kitchen is buying that very, very expensive organic mayonnaise, $9 a jar, that doesn't have canola oil in it. And I'm not a fan of canola oil, never have been. You know, canola is a made-up word. It stands for Canadian oil because it comes from the rapeseed plant. And you know darn good and well that that mustard family rapeseed plant would not be a good marketing name to use in the United States. And so canola oil was born. But actually, even though canola oil is a monounsaturated fat, it's just kind of a funky molecule. It's just a little bit longer than the width of the cell wall. And so when it integrates itself into the cell wall, because you wonder, you know, when you eat these fats, where do they go? What do besides sitting on your hips? What happens with these fats is they become part of your brain. They become part of your cell wall. They become part of your hormones. And so when you put a molecule in the body that isn't exactly like the way the body designed that structure to be, which is what happens with canola oil, you alter the membrane. And membrane health is really where it's at as far as I'm concerned. So anyway, back to the fancy schmancy organic mayonnaise with no canola oil in it. I'll take two parts of mayonnaise and one part of mild vinegar, like rice vinegar. Apple cider vinegar is a little strong in this particular formula. But if you like flavored things, you might use balsamic. You might use red wine vinegar as an alternative. But I happen to like the mild rice vinegar. One part of rice vinegar, two parts of that good organic mayonnaise, and one part of honey. So, depends on how much cabbage you have. Is it a teaspoon, and two teaspoons? Or is it a tablespoon, and two tablespoons? One part of mayo, I'm sorry, one part of honey, one part of vinegar, two parts of mayo. You get that kind of sweet, sour taste. And sometimes the cabbage is all green, and sometimes the cabbage is red. You might call it purple cabbage. Doesn't really matter. It's not green. And sometimes it's a little bit of both. Some people even are going to grate some carrot in there and make a tri-colored slaw. But the real tip I got was from my Lebanese girlfriend who said, put a little bit of onion in there. Not very much, just grate a little bit of onion and brighten the whole thing up. And so I've taken her advice for years and put that little bit of onion into that coleslaw. And yeah, baby. And remember, you don't want to make a lot of coleslaw at once. Because like all of the vegetables that are high in sulfur, it will become more bitter as it sits in the fridge for days. So when you're going to make your coleslaw, just make enough to have for lunch today and tomorrow. Don't make enough to eat for the week. Because those molecules are going to break down somewhat and they're going to create a little bit of bitterness in there. When we look at cabbage and collard greens and broccoli, we're looking at those sulfur compounds. We're looking at those really magical ingredients that are sulforaphanes. You've heard me many times talk about sulforaphane on the air. Because sulforaphane glucosinolate, these glucosinolates, these compounds that exist in the cruciferia or the brassica family, are really magical ingredients. I think the primary research has been done by Dr. Paul Talalay at Johns Hopkins University. He's the one that discovered this compound back in 1992. And he led the parade in terms of the research that's been done on broccoli, cauliflower, bok choy, and all the rest of these vegetables. Well, they found out that these glucosinolates or these sulforaphanes were highest in broccoli. And in fact, the younger the broccoli, the more glucosinolate was found in it. And then they found out it was even higher in the sprouts. And then they found out it was highest in the seeds. And so glucosinolates, yeah, I know it doesn't just roll off your tongue, sulforaphane glucosinolate, but sulforaphane, you hear the word sulfur in sulforaphane. The glucosinolates get converted into cancer preventative compounds. And this is really where the magic of these vegetables occurs. And so Dr. Talalay discovered that cancer cells wouldn't even grow in an environment that had these compounds of glucosinolate in them. And so that's one of the reasons that for years on the air I've recommended broccoli seed extracts, because of the fact that they are inhibitory to cancers. And there's been a good bit of cancer research specifically for colon cancer and breast cancer, but the risk of bladder cancer, prostate cancer, and ovarian cancer have all been found to decrease in relationship to the routine intake of everything from cabbage to kale. These glucosinolate phytonutrients, phyto for plant, So glucosinolate, you see, you can learn how to say all these words, sulforaphane, glucosinolate, phytonutrients. These anti-cancer compounds that are made from them inside the body. We've actually got an enzyme, and that enzyme takes these glucosinolates and converts them into isothiocyanates. Yeah. You thought it wasn't going to get any thicker. But remember, no-nonsense nutrition is about truth in advertising. It's about really trying to understand these compounds. But you can't just make it all about compounds. You know, there's magic that happens in vegetables because a whole bunch of different compounds are in there at the same time. I remember the rat studies that were done on prostate cancer with lycopene. Lycopene is the red pigment that you find in tomatoes and watermelons and guavas and even in pink grapefruit. And we know that men who eat several servings of cooked tomatoes every week have lower rates of prostate cancer than men who don't eat cooked tomatoes. Now, why cooked tomatoes? Because if you've ever made tomato sauce, you know it takes a laundry basket full of tomatoes in order to make a quart of tomato sauce. So you cook it down, and as you cook it down, the lycopene concentrates. So yes, the slice of tomato on the salad or on the sandwich still counts, but what counts even more is that concentrated version in that bowl of tomato soup, in the tomato paste that you mixed into a soup. Even in the lycopene concentrate that shows up on pizza sauce. Well, when they fed this to rats, they found out that if they gave the rats lycopene powder, it didn't work as good as if they gave them tomato powder. Because there are other agents, like vitamin C, that are in there at the same time. And there may be synergistic principles that happen when you put a couple of these beneficial compounds together. That's why you can't replace a bad diet with a handful of pills. Yeah, I'm a huge believer in supplements. Supplements help to get people out of the ditch. Supplements help to take care of individuals that for some reason genetically have a very high need for a certain nutrient. You know, why do I need 50 milligrams of B6 and you need 100 milligrams of B6? I don't know. We have those genetic uniquenesses, and that's where the supplements come in. But in the foods, Mother Nature's already done the job. You know, these plants have made these compounds to protect themselves. They could care less about you. Plants have made these compounds to protect themselves from the sun. Yeah, if you look at grapes, there's a dusting of yeast on the outside of the grape. You ever see that little powdery coating on the outside of a grape? That's sunscreen. The grapes put on sunscreen in order to keep from getting sunburned. It's one of the ways I learned to find my way in the woods when I was living up in Arizona, because there were certain kinds of plants that only grew on one side of the tree, away from the sun. And that helped you find north. Plants are smarter than we give them credit for. They make these compounds to keep from being eaten by bugs. They make repellents of various types. So the bug bites a plant, and immediately the plant not only sends a message through the entire plant to make a compound to repel the bug, but it sends it to the plant that's living next door and down the street and around the corner. Plants communicate with each other and tell each other, hey, there's a bug in the territory and he wants to take a bite out of you. So go ahead and make extra amounts of that particular compound that the bug doesn't like. So that's how we've gotten all these cool compounds in plants, like sulforaphane, glucosinolate, especially sulforaphane, glucosinolate, phytonutrients like isothiocyanates. See, you're going to have new cocktail party conversation as a result of listening to No Nonsense Nutrition. Well, what happens now? We eat that broccoli, or we eat the broccoli sprouts, because people don't eat broccoli seeds. But Dr. Talalay at Johns Hopkins found out that you could extract these glucosinolates out of these broccoli seeds, and you could put in a pill about 1 3/4 pounds of broccoli. And in fact, you could do a high test pill and you can end up with just shy of 5 pounds of broccoli. Well, I might be able to get you to eat 1¾ pounds of broccoli today if I made a broccoli omelet and made broccoli slaw for lunch and steamed your broccoli for dinner. But I bet you I couldn't get you to do it again tomorrow and the next day and the next day. So there is a place for using broccoli seed extract capsules in order to keep high concentrations of these sulforaphane glucosinolate phytonutrients in your bloodstream. Because people who've had a cancer are people who have a high risk for a cancer. They're the ones that we need to be putting this compound in on a very regular basis. I had a new client in my clinic this last week whose mother had ovarian cancer. She automatically goes on to a higher risk for ovarian cancer. I had a client a couple of weeks ago. Her mother had breast cancer, her sister had breast cancer, and now she's found out her other sister has breast cancer. These are the kind of individuals that I will recommend not only have coleslaw for lunch and broccoli for dinner, but are individuals that I will recommend that they take broccoli seed extract compounds as a supplement additionally. So when we look at the top of the cancer-related research, we're going to find these foods like broccoli and collards, like kale, but certainly like cabbage. And so maybe a little bit more coleslaw in the future of your life. Maybe a little slice off that red cabbage so that you chop it up and you put it in with the lettuce. Maybe a little less aversion to those cabbage rolls. In fact, we could do those cabbage rolls in tomato sauce. Remember when you saute that turkey meat so that you can mix it with the rice and the onions and use it to stuff the cabbage with? You could always put a couple of tablespoons of tomato paste in with that rice and turkey, because tomato paste has got 30 milligrams of lycopene in every tablespoon. And now I'm getting the sulforaphane and I'm getting the lycopene and, well, what's true is you're getting a delicious dinner. It just happens to have those agents in it. So when I saw that number six was how to cook cabbage, that lit up my life, because it isn't just cooking cabbage, it's eating cabbage raw that's so beneficial. Number five on the most Googled New Year's resolution questions was how to cook lentils. And lentils, compared to other kinds of dried beans, these are a tremendous benefit because they're really quick. They're really easy to prepare. Lentils and split peas and, frankly, even black-eyed peas. Unlike very many other of the dried pea beans or the legumes, don't have to be pre-soaked. Actually, none of the beans have to be pre-soaked. It's just a way to cut the cooking time. But lentils, along with these other type of beans, you know, they grow in pods. And so this is one of the reasons that they're really low on the pesticide residue list, because even if pesticides are used on them, the pods are protecting them and very little is actually getting into the bean. These little discs of lentils, sometimes smaller than the tip of a pencil eraser. And there's a number of different types. The tiniest ones are the green French lentils. But fundamentally, lentils are lentils. There's not a whole lot of difference in their cooking style or in their health benefits. But nutritionally, they're really a mighty member of the legume family. They're a very good source of cholesterol-lowering fiber. Not only do lentils help lower the funky cholesterol, or the LDL, but their special benefit, like all legumes, is keeping your blood sugar stable. You know, I did a review of the Blue Zones on the air a couple of months ago. And if you ever want to re-listen to any of these shows of No Nonsense Nutrition, remember you can go to the website Podomatic. Podomatic, and type in Plus News or just type in my name, and you're going to find out that there are literally hundreds, 200 in fact, shows that are there that I've done here on WSLR. This is a non-commercial site. It strictly has a replay of these lecture format shows. And it doesn't have a search engine, but it does have titles and buzzwords for each of the shows. So you can go backwards and you can find the show that I did this fall, last fall, last year, on the Blue Zones. The Blue Zones are the areas in the world where there is the greatest longevity, the greatest number of centenarians, the greatest number of people who are physically active, vital, and happening well into their senior years. And one of the things that clearly popped out when the Blue Zone research was done was the fact that they're all bean eaters. Everyone. And so some people avoid beans because they're, well, musical. But what's true is if you get a little bit, your enzymes actually get better at digesting it, digesting the bean itself. And we don't have the gas factory that can happen when people eat beans very infrequently. But anytime you're cooking beans, remember to add the beans to the boiling water instead of bringing the water to a boil with the beans in it. You'll actually reduce some of the gas forming capacity. And if you pre-soak the beans and you pour out that soak water, no, you're not pouring away the vitamins. The majority of things that are in something like a lentil or a bean are not soluble in water, because what we find in good concentration are things like minerals. In fact, lentils are highest in a mineral called molybdenum. And, you know, most people have heard of calcium and potassium and magnesium, but fewer people know anything about nutrients like molybdenum. But those are the things that are going to be found in beans. But when you pre-soak the beans, even when you're doing things like split peas and lentils, if you just even pour hot water on them and let that hot water sit for a few minutes and then pour off that water before you boil your water to put the beans into it, you'll reduce the gas-making properties of the oligosaccharides or the kinds of fibers that are present in the beans. So the special benefit is managing blood sugar, because their high fiber content prevents blood sugar levels from raising quickly after a meal. So anytime we've got beans, I went out to breakfast with friends yesterday, and they had huevos ranchos on the menu, the corn tortilla with the refried beans done with a fried egg on top. And so beans can even be in the breakfast. A black bean burger with a poached egg on top. Yeah, baby. Sounds good to me. You know, having that bowl of bean soup for lunch. Having hummus on your cracker. Having a bowl of chili for dinner. The idea is that we can put beans into our diet on a regular basis. And I think if we're looking for a New Year's resolution for 2016, what we might look at is having at least 4 bean-based meals a week. Think of your 14 lunches and dinners. Of your 14 lunches and dinners, how about 4 of them being bean-based? Whether it's a bowl of chili or a bowl of lentils, whether it's a black bean burger or it's hummus on the celery sticks. You're going to get those 7 most important minerals, the B vitamins, the protein, virtually no fat, and incredibly low in calories, with great fiber that fills you up but doesn't fill you out. These are fiber all-stars, the lentils. Both kinds of fiber, the soluble and the insoluble. This is one of the reasons the blood sugar stays so stable when we eat beans. So those people that live in the Blue Zone, whether they were in Loma Linda, California, or they were in Sardinia, Italy, no matter where they were in the world, and they all ate a different bean, having beans as a regular part of their diet helped to stabilize blood sugar, keep their bowel working good, because the soluble fiber that makes that gel-like substance in the digestive tract also snares out the bile acids. We have to use cholesterol to make those. So when you grab a hold of those bile acids, the cholesterol goes down. It actually ferries it out of the body. But beans also help to prevent digestive disorders. You know, I get so weary of the clients that come into the office and say, I have IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. I think IBS stands for I be stupid, because over and over and over again, I see that the gastroenterologists, and they're just missing the boat on how much of a difference these high-fiber diets make for individuals. It's really startling when we look at a study. There was a study in the Archives of Internal Medicine, and they studied eating high-fiber foods such as lentils to help prevent heart disease. There were 10,000 American adults that participated in this study, and they were followed for 19 years. We have very few studies that have that large a population covered for that long a period of time. But people who ate the most fiber, over 20 grams a day, had a 12% reduction in coronary heart disease and an 11% reduction in cardiovascular disease in general as compared to people who didn't eat very much fiber, 5 grams a day. Those eating the most water-soluble dietary fiber fared even better. They had a 15% reduction in the risk of cardiovascular disease and coronary heart disease. So when we look at the risk of death from heart disease, we analyze data. And one of the other studies that really sticks in my mind was a study that was done across the barriers of countries. They had people from the Netherlands and Finland and the U.S. and Italy and Yugoslavia and Greece and Japan. You know, this was an old study because Yugoslavia still existed. But they looked at food patterns and the risk of death from coronary heart disease over a 25-year period of time. There were much higher consumptions of dairy products in Northern Europe. There was much higher consumption of meat in the United States. There was higher consumption of vegetables and beans and fish and wine in Southern Europe, and higher consumption of cereals and soy products and fish in Japan. But when the researchers analyzed the data in relation to the risk of death from heart disease, they found that beans were associated with an 82% reduction in risk. Just like the Blue Zone said. So getting beans into your diet on a regular basis, don't forget the coleslaw, it really matters. And part of that may be that there are significant amounts of folate and magnesium in these little magic bullets. Folate, not folic acid. Folic acid is synthetic. Your body needs folate. Folate helps to lower levels of homocysteine. That amino acid has been connected to Alzheimer's. It's been connected to heart disease. It's been connected to very many things in the body. It's a part of a metabolic process. And if we don't have enough vitamin B6, if we don't have enough folate, if we don't have enough vitamin B12, we can't convert homocysteine back into a benign molecule, an amino acid like cysteine or methionine. If those B vitamins are not available, then levels of homocysteine increase in the bloodstream. This is a really bad idea because homocysteine damages the artery walls. It's a serious risk factor for heart disease. We used to call it an independent risk factor. Now we know it's not so independent. Plus, magnesium is in those beans. Magnesium has got its own beneficial cardiovascular effects. It's Mother Nature's calcium channel blocker. You've heard of calcium channel blockers used to control high blood pressure. Well, magnesium is a calcium channel blocker. When there's enough magnesium around, the veins, the arteries, they relax. And that improves the flow of blood and therefore oxygen and nutrients throughout the body. When somebody says they have leg cramps at night, I always give them magnesium. Somebody's got a twitch. They got a twitch in their eye. They got a heart palpitation. They got a stitch in their side. They need more magnesium. Now, not magnesium oxide or magnesium citrate. You take too much of that, you're going to get a loose stool. But magnesium in a chelated form, bound to an amino acid. Deficiencies of magnesium is not only related to a heart attack, it's related to that time immediately after a heart attack. using magnesium. Magnesium is involved in 300 different processes in the body. We need more magnesium. It's the single most depleted nutrient in the American diet. Zinc runs a close second. So when we think about how to cook lentils, that's a big long answer for number five. Lentils are really, really good for you, and you can have that bowl of soup ready in an hour. You don't have to make an all-day process out of it. I like lentils cooked with onions and carrots and a couple of bay leaves. You know, I like really good food fixed fairly plain. And then chop some fresh onion on top of it. Maybe a little splash of Worcestershire, a little splash of hot sauce, whatever rocks your world. But you should learn to cook lentils, too. I'm going to skip number four, which is how to write a resignation letter, because in the six part-time jobs that I have, I'm not interested in resigning from any of them. Whether it's being a programmer on the radio here or at WMNF, whether it's running my clinic or having my practice, whether it's teaching an HIV support group or teaching astronomy out at Siesta Key, or the newest hat that I'm wearing, being an educational director for a group of doctors to learn, well, how to teach them how to teach. I'm not going to resign. Number three, how much water should I drink to lose weight? Yeah, you wish. You wish is the answer that should have popped up on the Google search on that one. What's true is how much water you should drink is your body weight divided in half and expressed as ounces. So if you weigh 150 pounds, you need about 75 ounces of water a day. If you weigh 128 pounds, you need 64 ounces of water a day. That's 2 quarts. Try to get a quart in by noon, another quart in by the time the sun goes down. We don't want to provoke nightly urination. But how much water should I drink to lose weight? Honey, no. No, it's how many calories do you need to reduce in order to lose weight? You know, if somebody wanted one direction, not the band, but just one direction on how to lose weight, it's take out the beverages with calories. Just take them out. And don't substitute diet soda. I mean, we've learned, you know, from 2 studies that were released last year, that diet soda definitely contributes to weight gain over years. It's an illusion. You send a trick message to the brain. You send a trick message to the brain that it's going to get something sweet, and that it doesn't get something sweet. All you're doing is provoking more hunger. Not to mention all the other nasty ingredients that are in diet soda, most notably phosphoric acid, which contributes to osteoporosis. But how much water should I drink to lose weight? You're not going to drink water to lose weight. You're going to make lifestyle changes in your food choices if you're wanting to lose weight. Number two in the most Googled New Year's resolutions was how to make kale chips. Well, I got news for you. Kale shows up on the Environmental Working Group's list of the most pesticide-contaminated foods. Yeah, as kale has become more popular, you know, one of the big laughs I got out of last year was seeing the book 50 Shades of Kale. Yeah, really, it was true. Yeah, it's pesticide residue. So can collards be. Cabbage isn't, but collards and kale can sure show up with a lot of pesticide residue. Well, I get these foodies that come into my practice and they're juicing. And whether they're going to the fancy smancy juice shop and, you know, blowing $10 on a glass of juice, or whether they bought a juicer at home and they're doing all this juicing and, you know, it's a way to concentrate nutrients, but the question is, what kind of nutrients are you concentrating? I'm worried about the people that are using too much kale in their juice, and I'm going to tell you why. But let's answer the question first. Number two, how to make kale chips. Well, guess what? They're fried. They're fried. It doesn't matter what you heat up to 375 or 425 degrees. I don't care if it's organic oil that was processed by monks under a full moon. As soon as you cook that oil at 400 degrees for any period of time, you start making really nasty compounds in that oil. So, yeah, you can take kale, and there's all different kinds of kale. You know, you've got curly kale, you've got, you know, Tuscan kale. You're going to see different names on them, but it's, you know, we're coming down to the same thing. The nature of kale is to make kale chips. You got to fry them. Now, if you want to buy a piece of rainbow trout once a month and fry it in some oil and then you dish the oil after you've cooked your trout, I'm not going to lose any sleep over that. But as soon as you're having anything deep fried in oil, in fat, that's done in a commercial facility, I can guarantee you they are not changing that oil on a regular basis. You've heard me say this before on No Nonsense Nutrition. The client that we had that was a restaurant inspector told me that it is not uncommon that even in good, her words, good restaurants, the oil gets changed once a month. Ew. You just don't even know what kind of nasty compounds get made when you apply heat to that oil over a long period of time. So how to make kale chips? I am not going to endorse it. But I am going to endorse the eating of kale just like I have with collards and broccoli and cabbage. All members of that same family. But the real deal on kale is taking the science that we talked about earlier. Sulforaphane glucosinolate phytonutrient. That sulforaphane glucosinolate gets converted. And it gets converted in the body through the use of an enzyme into an isothiocyanate. Isothiocyanates can provide a lot of benefit, but they're also competitive for the thyroid. Goitrogens, which are compounds that can create goiters. Well, we don't see goiters much anymore, these abnormally enlarged thyroid glands. If you look at pictures of the goiter belt, the area of the Midwest, that's where the glaciers came down during the last ice age, and they shaved all the topsoil off in that part of the country. And as a result, there's very little trace minerals in the soil. And so when somebody doesn't get enough iodine, that mineral iodine, the thyroid will enlarge. It will get abnormally enlarged. And that can happen with either overproduction or underproduction, but generally the mineral iodine, if it's in deficiency, causes underproduction of thyroid hormones. In order to make thyroid hormones, you've got to have a soup. You've got to have protein. You've got to have vitamin B6. You've got to have minerals, not only iodine, but also selenium. We need a little zinc thrown in there as well. If you don't have all of those, you can't have optimal thyroid function. And any deficiency of those things increase the risk of goiters and thyroid problems. Well, like I say, we don't see these goiters, which just look like a pillow stuffed under your chin. But we're seeing more of them lately because a lot of people switched over to sea salt. And they didn't realize that sea salt was lower in iodine than iodized salt. You know, iodized salt was the very first time that we ever added a nutrient to a food. You know, you go in the grocery store today and you've got calcium added into your orange juice and you've got vitamins added into really crappy, nasty sugar bombs of cereal that you're feeding your children in the morning. All of those nutrient-supported things scare the heck out of me. But iodized salt doesn't, because the second that salt got iodized, we saw the number of goiters in the United States drop like a rock within just years after that was initiated. So if you're going to buy sea salt, you want to buy this fancy Himalayan pink salt, you want to buy the fancy Hawaiian black salt, make sure you get iodized salt. Because iodine and selenium are essential minerals that are found pretty sparsely in the food supply. One of the best sources of selenium is Brazil nuts. When you make up that handful of nuts, you're going to throw in a zip-top bag, one of those little snack-sized zip-top bags that you throw in your purse or in your briefcase or in your car or in your desk drawer so that you've got a healthy snack and you're not grabbing something funky. Throw one Brazil nut into every bag. Get that little bit of extra selenium. So these goitrogens or these isothiocyanates, Where I get worried is with the client that came in and she says she's making green juice every morning. And I go, great, what's in your green juice? Because, you know, if I've got 12 people, I've got 12 recipes. Oh, well, I take a bunch of kale and I put the kale through the juicer. And I went, whoa, 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 whoa. You're talking about the entire bunch of kale? Oh, yeah. You're talking about a dozen of those foot-long leaves of kale you're putting in the juicer? Oh, yeah, I do that every day. And sure enough, I look at her thyroid numbers, and they're nailed to the ceiling, meaning her TSH number is too high. She's blocking her own body's ability to manufacture thyroid hormone. The pituitary gland has a hormone called TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, that tells the thyroid how to work. It's the commander. It's the boss. It says, yo, thyroid, make some thyroid. And if you block that communication line, then the thyroid stimulating hormone keeps going up, because it's yelling at the thyroid in order to make thyroid. And so if we're eating too much of these goitrogens, if we're eating too much of these isothiocyanates, which are highest in kale, then we can block that conversion. So hear the double message here. On the one hand, I want you to eat coleslaw, and I want you to have broccoli, and I want you to have collards, and I want you to have all of these yummy things, but I don't want you to have too much, because these compounds compete with iodine for uptake into the thyroid. And excessive intakes of isothiocyanates have been associated with a potential risk for thyroid function, especially in the presence of an iodine or a selenium deficiency. Now, I'm talking extremely excessive. I'm talking about people eating pounds of raw cruciferous vegetables, which people don't do, unless you're juicing an entire bunch of kale into your green drink every day. You're putting a leaf or two leaves in there? I'm not going to worry about that. Isothiocyanates are sensitive to heat, and some of them are deactivated with cooking, so it's a real different deal. When I cooked those collards last night to have with my black-eyed peas and my cornbread, I've deactivated some of those isothiocyanates. I still get the benefit of the glucosinolates. See how easy it is to learn how to say these words? But I don't want an entire bunch of kale thrown into the juice. So how do you make kale chips? Long-winded answer again, but I don't want you making kale chips. I don't even want you buying kale chips. You know, you have a few now and then. I'm not going to worry about it. Kale, lentils, cabbage, collards, broccoli, 5 out of 10. Most Google New Year's resolutions were about getting healthier. Wow. This is really good news. America's waking up. America's realizing that diet soda is not the key to health. America's realizing that double cheeseburgers with bacon is probably not the best idea. Sure, there are plenty of people that haven't gotten the message. When I went to see the new Star Wars movie last Friday, I could clearly see by the people exiting the theater that Americans haven't gotten the message about health. But we're trying. If those are the things we're Googling with questions, we're trying. But the, drumroll, most Googled New Year's resolution question, how to get rid of stress. How to get rid of stress. You can't get rid of stress. You know, and that word was coined to indicate how we have to get sturdier to endure the pressures on us. And it was translated from steel beams to humans. Stress makes muscle tension, and muscle tension reduces blood flow, and it reduces oxygenation to the tissue. So really, relaxation is a lot about getting the muscles to relax. Taking a deep breath in your nose and out your mouth. In your nose, out your lips. That's one of the ways that you can reduce stress. You can't eliminate stress. You got to learn to manage it better. one of the first things that always comes to mind for me is the use of the amino acid theanine. It's got an L in front of it, L-theanine. Theanine is an amino acid that allows us to make a neurotransmitter called GABA, and GABA is the preeminent brake pedal of the body. And so when we begin to look at GABA, we can make more GABA if we have more theanine. So taking a capsule of theanine as soon as your feet hit the floor in the morning. If you're an anxious person and you've got an anxious day ahead of you, taking a theanine to start the day is fine. I have clients who've taken it upon arising, taken it again mid-morning, taken it again mid-afternoon, taken it again mid-evening or bedtime. Because you're always going to get the greatest absorption of an amino acid that you're using therapeutically if you take it on an empty stomach. So it's not competing with the aminos that were in your breakfast, lunch, or dinner. But theanine makes a big difference in helping us relax. But I think one of the things that we need to do is we need to have more strategies in terms of reducing our anxiety. Because the stress isn't going to go away. If you're going to have personal stress, you know, one of the greatest stresses to the human body is temperature. If you're too hot or you're too cold, nothing else matters. If you're too hot or you're too cold, people don't think about temperature stress as being one of the major stressors. Digestive stress. A lot of complaints we have are my stomach hurts, my gut hurts. So when we work with our physical body and get our body to be more comfortable, automatically our ability to endure the stresses that fly at us from the world improves. Remember in The Wizard of Oz when the monkeys fly in the window? So if you want to try to deal with the flying monkeys, the best way to deal with them is when you're feeling good. One of the great ways to reduce stress is to get enough sleep. People say, I'm too busy. I have to stay up till midnight. I have to get up at 5:30. You know, we measure a 15% increase in deaths for individuals who sleep less than 7 hours a night. And I don't care if you tell me I do fine on 5 hours. I don't believe you. Every test we can do demonstrates that you don't do well on 5 or 6 hours of sleep. Seven and more. Seven's the minimum. You know, when you're under 50 hours of sleep a week, you're already in trouble. You just don't have the resiliency to meet with the stress in the outside world. Well, I suggest that one of the ways that we can reduce our stress is learn how to cook kale and lentils and cabbage and collard greens and broccoli. Get a healthier body. That'll make a difference all by itself. You know, here on No Nonsense Nutrition, I try to give you practicum. I try to give you things that you can use right away. And hopefully today you'll have some coleslaw with your sandwich and maybe cook some collards tonight. It's Happy New Year time. Happy New Body time. Remember, 156 days from now, you've replaced the majority of cells in your body. So if you don't like the way your body feels right now at the beginning of the year, by the time we get down a little past Memorial Day, you could have changed it if you just changed those habits. Drink that extra glass of water. Have that extra serving of broccoli. And take a big, deep breath in your nose and out your mouth. I'm Eve Prang-Plues. I'm a licensed nutrition counselor in practice here in Sarasota, beginning, I know it's hard to say out loud, 28 years, but happy.